We'll have some interesting discussions today. Open with a prayer if you don't mind.
Almighty God, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, God, we ask your blessing upon today's study. We ask you to open our hearts and eyes and ears to you. Keep us focused upon you, God, to see what you want us to learn, to understand what you've given to us, to understand why you've given it to us, that we can learn from them and apply them in our own lives. God, we ask your blessing today on prophet study. In the name of your Son, Yeshua HaMashiach. Amen.
1 Samuel chapter 19. Now Saul spoke to Jonathan his son and to all the servants that they should kill David. But Jonathan, Saul's son, delighted greatly in David. So Jonathan told David, saying, "My father Saul seeks to kill you. Therefore, please be on your guard until morning, and stay in a secret place and hide. And I will go out and stand beside my father in the field where you are, and I will speak with my father about you. Then what I observe, I will tell you." Thus Jonathan spoke well of David to Saul his father, and said to him, "Let not the king sin against his servant, against David, because he has not sinned against you, and because his works have been very good toward you. For he took his life in his hands and killed the Philistine. And the Lord brought about a great deliverance for all of Israel. You saw it and rejoiced. Why then will you sin against innocent blood to kill David without a cause?" So Saul heeded the voice of Jonathan, and Saul swore, "As the Lord lives, he shall not be killed." Then Jonathan called David, and Jonathan told him all these things. So Jonathan brought David to Saul, and he was in his presence, as in times past. And there was a war again, and David went out and fought with the Philistines, and struck them with a mighty blow, and they fled from him. Now the distressing spirit from the Lord came upon Saul as he sat in his house with his spear in his hand, and David was playing music with his hand. Then Saul sought to pin David to the wall with the spear, but he slipped away from Saul's presence, and he drove the spear into the wall. So David fled and escaped that night. Saul also sent messengers to David's house to watch him and to kill him in the morning. And Michal, David's wife, told him, saying, "If you do not save your life tonight, tomorrow you will be killed." So Michal let David down through a window, and he went and fled and escaped. And Michal took an image and laid it in the bed, put a cover of goat's hair for his head, and covered it with clothes. So when Saul sent messengers to take David, she said, "He is sick." Then Saul sent the messengers back to see David, saying, "Bring him up to me in the bed, that I may kill him." And when the messengers had come in, there was the image in the bed, with a cover of goat's hair for his head. Then Saul said to Michal, "Why have you deceived me like this, and sent my enemy away, so that he has escaped?" And Michal answered Saul, "He said to me, 'Let me go. Why should I kill you?'" So David fled and escaped, and went to Samuel at Ramah, and told him all that Saul had done to him. And he and Samuel went and stayed in Naioth. Now it was told Saul, saying, "Take note, David is at Naioth in Ramah." Then Saul sent messengers to take David, and when they saw the group of prophets prophesying, and Samuel standing as leader over them, the Spirit of God came upon the messengers of Saul, and they also prophesied. And when Saul was told, he sent other messengers, and they prophesied likewise. Then Saul sent messengers again the third time, and they prophesied also. Then he also went to Ramah, and came to the great well that is at Succoth. So he asked and said, "Where are Samuel and David?" And someone said, "Indeed, they are at Naioth in Ramah." So he went there to Naioth in Ramah. Then the Spirit of God was upon him also, and he went on and prophesied until he came to Naioth in Ramah. And he also stripped off his clothes and prophesied before Samuel in like manner, and lay down naked all that day and all that night. Therefore they say, is Saul also among the prophets?
Thank you, David. That was 1 Samuel chapter 19. We'll be reading a few more things shortly from now, because there's more detail to this chapter than meets the eye. But are there any comments or questions regarding what we've discussed or what we've read before I begin? Yes, Gary.
Public nudity.
Say it again?
What's up with the public nudity?
Public
Isn't
nudity.
That not okay? Especially for a king?
It's definitely not okay. Well, I'll go ahead and answer that. I was going to answer it shortly, but I'll go ahead and answer it now. At that time of lifestyle, when you engaged a prophet, as far as when you discuss Samuel, now, of course, there'll be more prophets, Isaiah, Jeremiah, they all have students. The deal with students is that you have to identify yourself as being worthless as a student in order to show honor to the person who's teaching you. It's just a standard practice. And so the common use was you put on a student's robe, which is a extremely uncomfortable garment. And you'd wear that, and that is your livelihood until you have completed your studies. Usually it takes a good few 10, 15 years or so, and then you become a prophet yourself. And you have your own students. Thus you take off your robe and you're no longer a student robe. So normally when you become a prophet or a student of a prophet, you take off your garments. Not strip down public nudity, necessarily. You take off your garments, and you put on the new student robe. The student robe is assigned to you, depending on your size and nature. They are free. They're so thoroughly uncomfortable, no one would pay for them anyway, because they're usually made out of leftover sacks of things that are bags, that kind of thing. Very uncomfortable item. It does not necessarily mean, when it says that Saul stripped down, that he's actually completely naked. The term naked here is actually a term vulnerable. We are thoroughly vulnerable if we are naked. Completely. But we're also vulnerable if we remove everything that protects us. When a spirit being becomes flesh for a period of time to do a task, they are called naked. Well, they have clothing on, but they're actually called naked. Why? Because they're now vulnerable. Human beings are all vulnerable. You are now exposed. You can be hurt, attacked, damaged, whatever the case may be. He may, in fact, be naked. I won't say he's not, because the term can be used as complete nakedness. It's not commonly used that way, but it can be used that way.
But we can also become vulnerable when we take off the maybe the kind of clothing or the certain things that might reveal a status.
It does.
You know, like with a king, you know, if he takes off
his
purple
robes
and he's wearing common clothes, now
he's no longer king.
He's more vulnerable too.
Yeah, he's no longer king. David does the same thing in a few chapters from now when he dances before the ark of this moving guy. He claims that he's completely naked. It's using the same term. But it says he's not naked because he's actually wearing an ephod. Well, you can't be naked and not naked at the same time unless the term naked does not mean clothingless. Stripped away. Now, you're taking off your outer garments, taking off till you just have your inner garments left. You are naked, but you have just a few minor garments covering certain areas. you are naked, and so to speak. But that's it is a confusing term, and I will not argue that it is, in fact, one way or the other, just that it's a possibility he has not exposed himself. The reason I say that, because that is highly illegal according to the Torah. There are women around. There are children around. You were executed for doing so. And all the people would be executed if he completely exposed himself. So they would have to kill him. By law, he would be required, and Samuel being the witness, said, oh, Saul, you have removed all clothing. Guards, where's my knife? I go up and I can legally, because who Samuel is, slit Saul's throat. Kill the king. And with no repercussions. So the chance of him being completely naked, resulting in a death penalty, and then not having to be killed for it, is highly unlikely. Yes, Jimmy.
In verse 9, could you elaborate on then an evil spirit from the Lord came upon Saul?
That's the evil spirit. But the evil spirit has come upon Saul a couple of times now in these chapters. It came on the chapter previous to this when David was first anointed as king by Samuel. Two chapters ago, I apologize. Chapter 17, I think it is. Once Samuel takes the horn of oil, which God commanded Samuel to do so, God uses the phrase, a terminology, you will take your horn, fill it full of oil, and you will anoint the king that I have chosen. My king is actually the word that God uses. Saul was never called God's king, but David was called God's king. So God has specifically chose David out of all others as his own personal king. So when Samuel went over there and he anointed David, the spirit, the kingly spirit that identified Saul and gave Saul all of his power and strength, it says the moment David was anointed, that spirit left Saul and went to David. And another spirit from God, yes, from God, entered into Saul. The unacceptable, the one that causes danger, this melancholy or depression, a spirit of negativity designed to kill or to cause harm towards Saul. God sent it. Not, the devil didn't send it, nobody else sent it. God sent that spirit. Now, mind you, does that mean that spirit is an angel? No, nothing says it's an angel. Just as a spirit. God can command Satan to do whatever God says you will go do. God doesn't, typically, but he has the authority to do so. So God says, all right, I need a spirit to do a task for me. In this case, it's to manipulate Saul to do certain things that was against David in order to cause certain prophecies to come through between Saul and David that God needed later on. So God looks around and says, all right, demon number XYZ, whatever you are, I am now pulling the spirit, the protection spirit, away from Saul, my spirit. Please enter him. I didn't say please. I said enter him. So that spirit took over Saul by God's command. God has that authority to do so. Now, does he always do that for every application? Probably not. Does he remove his protective spirit? Well, sure, all the time. God can remove his protection over you based on your own actions. You've done something unacceptable. All right, I'll remove my protection. I won't necessarily cause evil to fall upon you, but I'll remove my protection so it can fall upon you. God has that ability to do so as well. It's completely within his realm and authority. Susan, your hand up next.
This refers to the previous topic about Saul taking off his clothes.
Oh, right.
It could be a Hebrew wordplay because the primary meaning of the word beged, which is translated clothing, is treachery, deceit, and then garment.
Yes.
And so it could be that Saul coming into Samuel's presence and the company of the other prophets, it could read, and Saul in like manner laid out, he stripped off his treachery and deceit and lay down before the Lord. In other words, coming into that presence, that evil spirit you've just been talking about, is stripped away from him, had to leave, because in the presence of God, there is no darkness.
That's true. That is a beautiful wordplay. And actually, I like the way you discussed that, because the treachery commentary, the Jewish commentaries argue, actually he took off all of his military clothing, everything that associated with physical, which is treachery, the whole nature of killing, to take all those items off. But whether they were right or wrong, I don't know. But that's an issue. It is. It can be done that way. It can be done that way. Yes, Ellie.
Usually what is physical is also spiritual and vice versa.
Sure.
So he would have done some physical manifestation of the spiritual laying away of his attitude. So he undoubtedly had both manifestations.
Off his armor. Yep, everything. Yes,
okay,
Richard.
My comment. I'm thinking Nebuchadnezzar.
Yes.
I mean, there was he put an evil spirit in him.
Yes, he did.
That came from God.
God did that to Nebuchadnezzar. That is true.
He does it.
Completely legitimate and beneficial to all of us that the fact he did so. Joshua.
Well, yeah, it makes sense to me because in Job, I think, Satan appears before, Yahweh and says, can I? So Yahweh has the say on what happens.
Right. And another reason when God says to bind Satan for 1,000 years, does he have to, build some unique kind of chain? No, it's Satan, you will now be bound. And thus he has to command. He will obey it. Any other hands? Okay. I'm going to get through this because there's a whole other chunk we have to read that's related to this chapter, which we haven't read yet. But I have to go through these commentaries before I get there, because it's something that David is a unique character, so we'll get to find a little bit more about him. As I spoke last week, what are the two spellings of Jonathan's name? Yonatan? Yahunatan and Yonatan. Yahunatan does what? God's word. Does exactly what God commands him to do. Yonatan does what? Human, his own stuff. I'm so-and-so's son. I'm Yonatan. In chapter 19 is another demonstration of the distinction of Jonathan's spelling. Why do I distinguish the spellings? Any recall as to why there's a distinction, why it's important to discuss this? Because Yahunatan is doing prophetic items. Yonatan is not. Yonatan is a human being. So, chapter 19 opens up. Saul calls forth who? Yahunatan or Yonatan? He calls Yonatan. Who arrives? Well, the next verse. Yahunatan arrives. No, these aren't two different people. It's two different spellings of the same man's name. Yahunatan is a gift from Yahweh, Yahoo's gift. Gift to David. Gift to the Israelite people. He is a great, fantastic warrior. He sets the stage, so to speak, for David's arrival. Very similar, as we discussed last time, as John the Baptist did for the Messiah's arrival. Everything that John the Baptist was associated with regarding the Messiah and prepping him and taking care of him and doing things ahead of time, Yahunatan does also in David's time. They're the same people. They're symbols of each other. God's using Yahunatan's life to define what Elijah and John the Baptist are going to do and have done. They're very, very similar. They have a lot of similarities. Now, have everything that Yahunatan, David's friend, Jonathan, is everything he's done, has it all been completed by John the Baptist and Elijah? No. Part of it has, but not everything. John the Baptist is called a warrior for a reason. Yahunatan was a great warrior, second only to David, for a reason. They are one of the same friends. They are best mates, so to speak. I use that term. Saul calls his son, expecting his son to arrive, but he doesn't. The gift from God arrives instead. And what does the gift from God do? Defends David. He says, you will not do this, Saul. This is an evil thing. And convinces him that this is evil to try to kill David. So, Yahunatan, the gift from God, versus Yonatan, which is just gift, does something. He actually protects and defends and saves David's life. So that's, it's always important to remember that. I'll point it out periodically when it shows up. That throughout the chapters of Jonathan and Jonathan's name, depending on what's happening, dictates how he's spelt. When he's doing something on David's behalf and on God's behalf, it's spelled Yahunatan. When he's doing something on his own behalf or Saul's behalf, it's Yonatan. So Saul calls all of his advisors to do what? What's his goal? Kill David. Oh, why? Saul tried to kill David. He can do it himself, right? Why doesn't Saul just kill himself? Saul's a warrior. Saul's killed lots of people. What's one more? Well, Saul attempted to do so. Saul has failed to killing David. Why is that? David took off. David avoided his spear a couple of times. Saul tried to put him in harm's way, the Philistines, and David survived that. Saul, at this point, is fully aware that David is not so easily killed. In a few chapters from now, actually I think it's next chapter, Saul states that God is with this kid. Saul knows, I cannot kill him. But it doesn't mean somebody else can't. It is in Saul's best interest and Yonatan's best interest for David to be dead. Why is that? So Jonathan will be king. So Saul's king line continues. Does Saul know that Samuel already told him specifically the throne will be ripped out of from your hand, from your garment, and be given to another? Yes, he knows that. Is that other person probably David? Yes, he knows that too, because people are saying he's practically king. Actually, Saul's saying he's practically a king. So Saul knows who the person has been selected, but if that person's dead, I extend that prophecy from Samuel at least one more generation, at least if somebody else shows up. It's in Saul's interest to kill David. It's in Jonathan's interest to kill David. But it's not in Yahunatan's best interest to kill David. David's friend. David's companion. So, obviously, David's scared for his life. Jonathan points out, no, it's okay. Hide in the field. I'll go out. I'll bring Saul out there. We'll discuss this where you can hear. You're hidden. We know where you're at. Saul does not. Verse 6. Saul listened to Jehonatan's voice, and Saul swore, this is a key thing, as the Lord lives, he shall not die. What did Saul just do? Took an oath. What kind of oath did he just take? In the Lord's name. What does that mean? He's bound by it, and what happens if he breaks that oath? He's a dead man. Because what also it happens when you take the Lord's God's name in vain? That's called breaking one of the main commandments. I believe it's the fourth commandment, if I recall correctly. Thou shalt not take the Lord's name in vain. You do not swear upon his name and make it worthless. If Saul now kills David, tries, you can split hairs. Well, he didn't technically kill him. If Saul kills David, he has broken one of God's main Ten Commandments. He has broken his oath, and he has a witness, Jonathan's there, witness, and David's hearing it also. These are all things that Saul put himself in a very precarious situation. He cannot allow David to be killed. At this point forward, he can't. He swore to God that he would not. You watch what you say. You don't just arbitrarily spit out words. This is an important thing to do. Ellie.
There's a scripture that says if you put a curse on someone and it does not fit on that person, then it comes back upon the person who made the curse. And so this is a reverse of that exact same thing. When he said that he wouldn't, if he does, then scripturally, even later in scripture,
what he
but it comes back
kill.
On him, what he might.
Right, right. Now, technically, Saul doesn't successfully kill David, but he puts David in harm's way and attempts to kill
hope
him.
So, right.
So for all practical purposes, Saul has killed David in his own heart, by definition, many, many times, just unsuccessfully doing it physically. He is tempting God. You're absolutely right. You are using God's name to verify that what you swear will be held true, even after you die. It doesn't end when you die. Well, you know, say, I made a pact. Well, I happen to have cancer, and guess what? I'm dead tomorrow anyway, so yeah, I'll swear whatever I want. No, it must be perpetual. That includes your offspring. Nothing is to have harm to this person. Now, David and Jonathan make pacts as well, using the name of God. Yes, Hank.
The oath is dependent on David's life term, not
right.
his own.
Right.
As David lives, or as Yahuwah lives,
as God
David
lives.
Will
right.
live.
Right. Yes.
You know.
Well, right. As far as long as God doesn't die, because he's the only person who can guarantee this oath is going to be carried out, then David will not die. Meaning being killed. Actually, not dead. He actually uses for kill as to be killed, as opposed to dying on his own. Well, it's every flesh and blood human being dies on their own. But to be killed, and of course, by Saul's hand, not by somebody else's hand. David and Jonathan make similar pacts, using the name of God in their words. They carry them out, though. They don't fall back on that. They use the name of God, and they mean it, and they carry it out. In Saul's case, he clearly did not mean it. Why? Because the spirit that God sent to Saul is influencing him and bringing out Saul's, how should I say it, much darker side. the true heart of Saul is to kill David. Saul knows, and actually Saul's mentioned in the previous chapter to Jonathan, it is in your interest that I do this. That's the heart of a man doing that. That's Saul's heart. That's his being wanting David dead. I'm sorry, say it a little louder.
Do you not think that when Saul made that oath, at the moment he made the oath, that he meant it wholeheartedly?
Sort of. Let's see, verse 4. I'll go back a few verses and discuss the conversation we have between Jonathan and Saul. So Jonathan spoke favorably of David to his father, saying to him, "Let the king not sin against his servant David, for he has not sinned against you, and because his deeds are very good for you. He put his life in his hand and slew the Philistine, and the Lord granted a great salvation to all of Israel. You saw it and rejoiced. So why should you sin with innocent blood to kill David for no reason?" The argument that Jonathan's using is that David hasn't actually sinned against you, Saul. Thus, you should not sin against God by killing him. Now, as opposed to David is our national hero, why would you do such a thing? There's two different perspectives going on here. Jonathan's using a convincing of a Torah argument. He has committed no crime, thus he is not to be killed. Is that not good enough for you, Saul? Okay, you're right, Jonathan. He did not. He has committed no crime against me, thus I cannot kill him. But Saul attempted to kill David via the Philistines. Put David in harm's way. Well, I didn't kill him then. I have intended to kill him. The Philistines would kill him. It didn't work. Saul's not using, I don't believe it was truly a heartfelt, I will thus David will live and be perpetual. Because if that's the case, if it truly is heartfelt, then its sole responsibility for all of Saul's action lies only upon the spirit that God sent to Saul. In which case, Saul is absolved from all actions. Absolved from all mistakes. Absolved from anything he did wrong. But Samuel in the previous chapters did not give Saul that way out. So Saul, you obey the people's voice instead of the voice of God. By obeying people's voices instead of God's voice, God will rip the throne from you. You are easily swayed from one perspective to another's perspective. Saul's heart is not truly following God. It's following whatever the will of the local people are doing at that moment in time. It has been so far many times in the few chapters we've gone through. So Saul is a person who's easily persuaded from one to the other side by just a few words. That's kind of a wishy-washy kind of person. That's not a true heart, deep heartfelt type of person. So that's my argument. I don't believe this is truly heartfelt in Saul's agreement here. We're going to go through this a little faster. I apologize for some of you who have any of the questions about it. So, of course, David hears it. Jonathan says, "Hey, it's okay. We're all good. Go back." David's singing again. Saul's upset. Saul has a spear. I don't know why someone wanders around their house with a spear in their hand, but for some reason Saul does. And he has it, and he throws it, and, of course, he misses David again. If I recall correctly, he misses him twice. It could be just the once. I'm not quite sure. Anyway. David runs away, escapes at night. Where does he go? Verse 11. Where does he go? David's house. Where's David's house at? Say it again. The palace. No, David's not house, not the palace. It's in the same city. It's in Saul's city, which is Gibeah. Gibeah of Benjamin, not Gibeah of Judah, by the way. There's a couple of different cities. Saul's Gibeah is where his whole kingdom is at. Now, is Saul's kingdom great and big and grand? No. Saul's kingdom is very small. It's his home. It's Saul's house. Saul lives here in Gibeah. He's a farmer. When David moved from Bethlehem, which is where his family is from, where he was born, coincidence to Messiah's birthplace, he has to go to Saul's court, which is in Gibeah. The whole city of Gibeah is Saul's court, Saul's livelihood. But it's not a castle. There is no massive court built for Saul on Saul's behalf. It's a town. It's just a town, like any other town. Probably has maybe a couple thousand people, possibly that many. Note the size of Saul's army, about 5,000 men total of all of Israel. Well, how does a small town support a bigger army? It doesn't. A small town can support a small army. Now, Saul's men, a small number of them, live there in Gibeah, along with David as their main commander. That's his house. That's all it is. He has a house given to him. He goes to the house. Saul sends messages to his house. It is, at this point, it's quite clear that Saul's messengers agree with Saul. Their willingness to kill David. Jonathan did not. Saul's messengers did. Now, previously, Saul told his messengers, previous chapters, to tell David, no, take Saul's daughter as your wife. We like you. Well, obviously, that was a lie. Now, they don't like him. They're willing to kill him for it. And David actually gets upset with them for doing so. But he curses them with such a unique curse, which we'll read shortly, of these particular individuals, that what their actions will never be forgotten. Which we'll get there when we get there. Because during this night, his wife, Michael, whatever, how I pronounce her name, Michal, told David, saying, if you do not act to escape with your life tonight, you will be killed tomorrow. Why is that? Well, of course, she can see the messengers like anybody else can see them. They're all there in the town. Gibeah is not that big of a town, by the way. Everybody knows who's doing what. Everybody knows who you are. Everybody knows what the messengers are doing. We're killed tomorrow. So all the town is probably fully aware that David is not liked by Saul by now, because the whole town is a military town. It doesn't take a genius to put two and two together. But Saul's attempted to kill David a numerous times, and now he sent messengers out to David's house to watch it. That's not a good sign. So Michal lowered David, verse 12, through the window, and after he escaped, fled and escaped that night. She took, my book says, mannequins or images of whether it's David's image or some figurine that looks like a human being. It's hard to say. Yeah, some do household idol. The Hebrew term, they argue it that it is in fact a duplicate image of David. I doubt it. But it could be. Duplicate images of David, I what do I know? I wouldn't argue it. They claim the reason why you would do that is because if your husband or whatever is off to war, it will somehow allow you to be reminded of him. And that's probably the emptiest thing I could possibly read regarding that possibility, but you know, so somebody wrote it down, they felt the need to publish it. It's most likely a statue of some form. Now, it could be, what, say it again? It is the same word. Yes, it is the same word as household idol. But you're allowed to use, depending on what the idol is used for, you're allowed to do a couple different things with it. One, yes, you could worship it. The other is you could actually try clothing on with it. Try clothing on with it, if it matches your body size. It's actually, it's not, the term of a mannequin is the same word you would use for an idol. It is the image of a human or image of a thing. That's all it is. So it could be an enormous full-size structure of a human being. Exactly. You don't do certain things. So what it is hard to say. Whether or not she is in fact an idol, by the way, in case you're unaware, we are not in the Torah anymore. So it could in fact be an idol. We're not in the Torah. We're outside. These are humans now. We're not, you know, discussing laws. They all break laws. That's not the nature. So it couldn't back be an idol. Yes, Gary.
Well, I was going to say maybe in that case, in light of what Sue said, maybe it could be something that you know the women sewed with, or you know, she'd make clothes for her husband, and I don't know.
It's to build a body. Yes. Mm-hmm. To make it look like a person. So, which brings the Jewish perspective that says it was built of David's likeness to remind her of David. I don't buy that, but it's hard to say. Yes, Ellie. Oh, sorry.
Yeah, maybe they shouldn't give prisoners Bibles.
Oh, good point.
One of the things that people's concept of clothing and things is different than now. You had a place to put your clothing even 200 years ago. You didn't have all your clothes in the closet. You take them, run them through the washer dryer, hang them back up. Things were put together by hand, and it would not have been unusual for there to be a structure to put your either military garments on or your kingly garments on to hold them through the night while you didn't have them on. You didn't throw them on the floor in the corner, and you didn't hang them up in a closet. So that would not have been an unusual thing to have had a form your shape.
It's very good possibility. I won't go into much further than that. It's because it's too subjective as far as what in fact the object actually was. Is it relevant to our story? Sort of, but not directly relevant. Should I talk about that? Well, I'm going to cheat a little bit. Hope you don't mind. When David, before he gets lowered this night down to the window by Michael, what's he doing? No? Say it again? What was David doing the night while he sees the messengers outside and sees them down there and Michael saying, you got to get out of here. What's David doing? Escaping? Well, not yet. Before he actually escapes. That night, what's he doing before he's lowered down? Keep in mind, what is David? Well, he's a warrior. But you know, there's one thing he's really known for? He's a songwriter. He writes stuff down. How many of you know musicians? Some of you are musicians. How many of musicians have a natural tendency to express themselves in music? Well, that makes you a musician is the whole term of expressing yourself in music, the whole principle behind it. David writes. David writes a lot of psalms. Yes, this is Psalm 59. We're not going to read there just yet, but that's where Psalm he wrote the night this happened. The same night it happened. As it was happening, he wrote it. But we have to finish our commentary before we go there. Say it again? It says he wrote it the night it happened. Now, it could have actually technically wrote it after he was lowered down. Hard to say. But the way he's writing it in the words of that psalm, it's as if he's sitting there at the window looking at him. It's that kind of wording. We'll discuss that as we read that chapter. So she lowers him down. David escapes. Saul gets upset. He says, messengers, oh no, what's going on? Where? He brings Michael. Says, what have you done? And she lies to him. Now this is interesting. Lying to the king. Well, is that acceptable?
Lying to your dad.
That makes it better. Say it again.
He wasn't the king.
David calls him the king. He is the king until he dies or until David kills him. David doesn't kill him, so he dies. David considers him the king. God may not, but David considers him the king. He is classified as the anointed of God, because he was anointed, and he was anointed by God. So only God is allowed to kill him, as far as David treats him. So one could argue he's not technically king, so let's reword it. He's lying to the anointed one of God. Is that acceptable behavior? Would God condone such things? Lying to the king? Lying to his anointed one? If you're Irish.
It's about as acceptable.
Hold on a minute. Go ahead, Josh.
I think it's about as acceptable as eating the showbread in the temple.
You know, funny how that is. People are not necessarily Torah observant, per se. But we'll discuss what the repercussions are. Kathy, I believe it was.
I just was thinking about the midwives when they lied to Pharaoh.
Lied to Pharaoh, exactly. Think about this. Did God ever command someone to lie to Saul? Yes. Who did he command to lie to Saul? Let me rephrase that. Did God command a person to lie to Saul? Yes, he did command a person to lie to Saul. He had commanded Samuel to lie to Saul. as all confused looks. What? What? God commanded Samuel. What? All right. Back when God commanded Samuel, you will go anoint David. And Samuel said, well, wait a minute. Saul knows I have to go anoint somebody. If he sees me, he will kill me, and rightfully so. And did God say, no, Samuel, he won't kill you? No, he didn't. He said, oh, yeah, you're right. Bring an animal with you. And if he asks, say, I'm just going to sacrifice an animal. But he didn't. He was deceiving, though. You're purposely leaving out details is no different than lying. sin of omission, it's still a lie. Yes, and well, just because I didn't tell you the whole truth doesn't mean I wasn't telling you the truth. No, I'm sorry. That's garbage. He was going to anoint someone. And now, granted, did Saul's men find Samuel? Well, in this case, no, they actually didn't. But God told him to tell what to say. Just in case. Because is it right that Saul would kill Samuel if Samuel chooses to or goes off and anoints another king? Torah, it actually is allowed. Because an anointed one of God, a kingly, this king person has been put on there, only God can take down. You can't get to usurp it. You don't get to go around. Samuel will be killed for treason. Completely acceptable reason for a king to kill someone. This is treasonous. Yes, you are killed for it. You know, sorry, that's just life. Or the end of your life, per se. So it's okay to kill someone if they are rebellious. God does it all the time if they're rebelling against the anointed one of God. Saul is still anointed. Now, once Samuel anoints David, treason has now ended in God's eyes. Because Saul is no longer the anointed one of him. David is. And now if Saul chose to kill Samuel after he anointed David for this act, it would be complete and utter murder. Punishable by death in the Torah. But leading up to that, it's not the case. It's very unique splitting of hairs of how we're dealing with this. It's a funny scenario to be going through. Hold on a minute. Sorry, I had to get you on the thing.
No, I just wanted to say that Michal's lie is in a way permitted. It's just like, is it okay to do good on the Sabbath, you know, to heal on the Sabbath? You can do things, you can take your donkey out of a pit on the Sabbath in order to save a life.
You're absolutely right.
So there is a provision. You can break the Torah when it means the saving of a life.
Yes, you can. And whose life is she saving? Her husband and her own.
Well, and also, but he's the anointed one.
He is the anointed one. She's saving the life of David. She's attempting to. But also her own at this point. She's saving both lives. She's breaking the Torah completely by lying or being rebellious against the anointed one of God. But on the other hand, she's obeying the Torah completely because she's protecting the anointed of God. We have two anointed people. Which one is right? Well, she chose. She said, I believe David is the proper one. David is the one who's right in this scenario. That's all. And she said, I will lie on his behalf. No, she's a human being. She's allowed to lie. We all are. Will God hold her accountable for this lie? In my opinion, probably not. Probably not. As a result, it saved her life, because Saul probably would have killed her. He killed anybody else who lied to him. Why not her? She's no special. She's not his firstborn daughter. She's given her heart to David. He knows that. She's treacherous to him as far as he's concerned. She's worthless. And he isn't even possessed. He's killed people for less. So would he kill his own daughter for this? For lying to him? Sure. Would he kill his own daughter had she told him the truth? You better believe it. So, unfortunately for her, her life didn't turn out so well either way. It fizzled out toward the end for her own mistakes. So which would be better off? Yeah, hard to say which one's which. Yeah, scary.
Well, aren't you also allowed to lie to your enemy? And I don't mean like your social enemy, but...
Yes, you are. Because David lies.
You know, yeah.
David lies to the Philistines. He pretends he's a madman. Is he a madman? No. Of course he lies to them. So lying is a unique tool. It's not a tool designed for people to use. It's a tool designed for God to use. God sends lying spirits, we read about them all the time, to achieve certain tasks that he needed to have done. It's up to the person if they choose to believe the lying spirit. That's their business. But God's one who can send them. So lying is a unique tool. God didn't build us with the ability that he didn't have. He didn't build us with some unique, oh, hey, God, guess what? I can lie and you can't. Wait. He designed it. He knows how it works. He knows what deception is. That's how he identifies it. He says, I am not a deceiver. I don't deceive. But others will. And I will use them as tools when I need them. Yes, Jeff.
Well, one of the things that people always bring up about the ethics of lying and such is that you, one of the old adages is you shouldn't lie because then you won't have to remember every lie that you've ever told.
Right.
In other words, people don't know everything. They don't know all the outcomes of every action or everything that happens. So it is the most logical and the best way to go to not lie, because you have no idea the outcome of anything, and best to leave God's will to his own. However he wants to make that happen, it will happen.
Exactly. Now, had Michael not lied, she would have been killed. Probably. Based on Saul's previous and future actions, he killed people for much less. Probably would have killed her. Or possibly had her killed, hard to say. Would that have been such a horrible thing? Only if you fear death. So did she have to lie? No. She didn't have to. She felt justified. She felt there was a reason behind it. She felt she was doing something right. But she didn't actually have to do it. Could have God saved her? Well, technically, he could have. He could have changed Saul's heart at that moment, as you just pointed out. Because Saul may not have killed her. He could have said, you told me the truth. He could have. Likely, but hard to say. Could have. So she didn't have to lie. But she chose to. This is the stickiness of getting into people's lives, not Torah lives. Human beings are human beings. We lie, cheat, and steal. That's our nature. Some of us are very good at it. Torah doesn't commend liars, cheaters, and thieves. Doesn't say, oh, you guys are all wonderful people. It doesn't. Does God use lying? Yes. But leave the tools to God as a wiser overall perspective. Like you pointed out, in her life, it didn't turn out good either way. Had she been killed by Saul at that moment in time, it may have actually turned out better. Hard to say. Joshua.
Yeah, I just reminded me of the passage that says, you know, God is not a man that he can lie. Or
right, that he would lie, that he lies. He's not a man that does so. It doesn't mean he can't say, hey, you, liar, go talk to that person. The liar, what does the liar do? Yes, sir, go talk to that person. He can use the tool. It doesn't mean he himself necessarily does it. Hank.
Do you think Samuel's lie was, what's the word you used? Was a have-to?
Was a have-to? I think because Saul's men didn't find Samuel, I think it was nothing more than God saying, I'll make you feel comfortable. That's what I think. But God still gave him that provision. Make him feel better about it. Because God didn't lie. God told Samuel, if you need to lie, go ahead and lie.
He didn't make Samuel lie either.
He didn't, and he didn't actually make him. He just made Samuel feel better, feel more comfortable, feel like he was protected. That's all it was. Ellie.
Also, in the Torah, we see the sin and repercussions of it.
Yes.
When we're in this text, if you had all the repercussions of everything all these people did, the book would be so huge we couldn't carry it around. So we do not know what the repercussions of each of these incidents were.
Very true. Go ahead. I mean,
yeah, you could see one possible repercussion of the particular lie that Michael chose to tell her father. Is that basically she implied that if she hadn't let him go, that David himself would have killed her.
Right.
So a possible consequence of that, when you see that later on, that she gets married off to somebody else. So she, because she had said that, well, David wanted to kill me, or David would have killed me if I didn't let him go. Well, then why are you still loyal, so loyal to him that you didn't want to marry this new man that I want you to marry? You know, why are you so loyal to David? He was going to kill you.
Mm-hmm.
So she, you know, those sort of possible repercussions of her loyalty to David and having to be able to explain later on why she wanted to be loyal to David after she had said something like this about him basically behind his back, this kind
exactly.
of thing. So there are always repercussions when we say stuff like that. We just don't necessarily see it.
That's very true. Very true. Bill.
Would any of this fall under Ecclesiastes?
Say it again.
Would any of this fall under Ecclesiastes?
Fall under Ecclesiastes. Explain yourself. What do you mean?
There's a time and place for everything under the
time
sun.
Time and place for everything under the sun? You know, I can see that in many ways. In this particular instance, because it wasn't a necessary thing, it probably was not the time and place. Probably was not the time and place for it. It wasn't a necessary lie. She didn't have to do so.
There is.
But are there times that you must lie? You know what? Tell you the truth. If I'm a human being, if my children were in jeopardy, whatever, and somebody's going to come to kill them, and I had to tell them the truth, where are they hidden? Would I lie? You better believe I'd lie. I'm sorry, I am a human being, and I would lie, whatever the repercussions are. Would God be happy about me lying? Maybe, maybe not. Would I care at the time? Probably not.
Be happy, actually, because, well, in the book of Deborah, Barak, and I can't remember the woman's name who put the stake through.
Jael.
Yes. And she lied to him.
Yes,
you know,
she lied
so
to him.
So I think that was God's will.
It very well could be. Unfortunately, that's up to subjective at this point in time. I need to move on because I'm out of time, but I can't just stop here because Psalm 59 is a very important psalm. I apologize for those of you who are tired and probably want to go eat. We'll read this. It's the Psalms 59. This is a psalm that David wrote. We do not have the musical instrument to go with it. We just have the words, so bear with me.
Sing
and dance. This is the chief musician set to Do Not Destroy. Whatever music that is, it would have been great to have, but it's not. A mixed psalm of David when Saul sent men and they watched the house in order to kill him. Verse 1. Deliver me from my enemies, O God. Defend me from those who rise up against me. Deliver me from the workers of iniquity, and save me from bloodthirsty men. For look, they lie in wait for my life. The mighty gather against me. Not for my transgression, nor for my sin, O Lord. They run and prepare themselves through no fault of mine. Awake to help me, and behold, you therefore, O God, O Lord God of hosts, the God of Israel, awake to punish the nations. Do not be merciful to any wicked transgressor. At evening they return, they growl like a dog, and go all around the city. Indeed, they belch out with their mouth. Swords are in their lips, for they say, who hears? But you, O Lord, shall laugh at them. You shall have all the nations in derision. O you, his strength, I will wait for you. God is my defense. My mercy, God, shall come to meet me. God shall let me see my desire on my enemies. Do not slay them, lest my people forget. Scatter them by your power and bring them down, O Lord, our shield. For the sin of their mouth and the words of their lips, and let them even be taken in their pride, and for the cursing and lying which they speak. Consume them in wrath, consume them that they may not be, and let them know that God rules in Jacob to the ends of the earth. I'm not going to go through this verse by verse, but there's certain components in this particular chapter that I want to point out because they have far-reaching repercussions that we still see today amongst these same individuals. First of all, of course, David begins, so God, deliver me, help me out. He points out, I have done no evil. This is not something that I deserve. This disaster is coming upon me. He looks upon me, see, examine. And David, in verse, I think this is verse 5 or 6. Verse 5. You therefore, O Lord of hosts, the God of Israel, awake to punish the nations. Now, he is comparing, unfortunately, the way the English wording is not quite the same as the Hebrew wording. The Hebrew wording states, you therefore, O Lord, a God of hosts, you awake and punish nations. Do not be merciful to any wicked transgressor. Singular, not plural. He's comparing his plight with all the nations. He's usually uses it more than once. Compares to all the nations. God, you punish bad people throughout the whole world. I am no different. I am an innocent person with a bad people. In this case, it's not many, it's a few down here at this end. But this is the one thing that fascinates me, which I want to point out. Does he tell God to kill them? No. Why not? So they wouldn't forget. Who wouldn't forget?
I was going to say, because he entrusts himself to, you know, him who judges rightly and vengeance is... I mean, David has an absolute trust that he will do as he pleases.
That is very true. But I believe, I could be wrong here, that God writes down our words. What we say has more far-reaching repercussions. What repercussions is David saying here? Because he points out in this verse, their lying lips, blah, blah, blah. I know, yeah, sorry, David. Verse 11, do not slay them. Don't kill them. At least let people forget. Scatter them instead. Disperse them. Make them, as it points out, hungry dogs. Dogs that gnarl, hungry dogs. I mean, they have no consequence. Disgusting things. Scatter them. Granted, the word scatter is also used for the word to destroy. Why is scattering better than killing in David's scenario?
Because you can scatter and you can regather. But if you snuff out, then there's no inheritance or lineage.
No, what does that mean to least the people forget? The ones that scatter will not forget, and they'll say, I have been scattered. Exactly. She's absolutely right. If you kill somebody, what happens? Oh, yeah, so-and-so lived and so-and-so died. I told my wife this morning, does anybody know who the second Caesar was that was killed? That's the foggiest idea. The second Caesar that was killed. I don't know. Does anybody know the first man shot in the Revolutionary War? It's not the foggiest idea. Why? Because he's dead. He's a dead guy. That's all, he's just dead. Well, whatever happened, dead. How many of us know about a small little nation known as Israel that was pathetically tiny and did nothing of significant value to anyone? Is still alive. We all know about them. They've been scattered. The reason I'm bringing this up, the whole point of why I'm covering this, and why David, I believe why David wrote this down, and why God needed him to write this down. In our story, I talked about that Jehonatan was who? Well, it's equivalent to John the Baptist. Well, what does that make David? Messiah. He's a messianic figure. He's a savior type figure. What does that make Saul? No. Saul's the guy in charge right now. Pharisees, Sanhedrin, Herod. Depending on which moment in time, Saul kind of shifts his personality a little bit. In case you hadn't noticed. What other characters are here in our story? Michael, which is a character. The people are also characters. In the previous chapter, same as a character as well. The previous chapter, two chapters. So what do the people think of David? Loved him. He was the best. Saul hated him. Why? Because it threatened Saul's power. In my opinion, this is made Daniel Agee's opinion, the psalm in most of David's life, this particular psalm and other psalms we'll get to as he goes through the story of fleeing Saul, David is actually mapping out chunks of Messiah's life. And so by cursing these particular individuals who are servants of Saul, also known as servants of the Sanhedrin, also known as what we would call Jews of power, so to speak, if I use that terminology, it can be termed negative, but I'm not really meaning it in a negative term, per se. Don't kill them, God. Rather, scatter them amongst like dogs. Now, what are dogs? Not the animal. What's the symbol? Gentile. Make them scatter like hungry goyim looking for who? Me. Interesting parallel. Look at that. Make the Jewish people scatter amongst the Gentiles who are hungry for the Messiah. It's actually a slightly prophetic statement, isn't it? One could argue it's a lot more than slightly, but still, it's a prophetic statement. David's actually setting up a scenario. God, don't kill him. Did the Messiah want all the people killed? No. What did he do? Well, all of a sudden, go out. Go out amongst the people. Talk to them. Bring them back. Return the scattered who I have scattered. God is the one who scatters, and God's the one who makes return. So David's telling him, don't kill them. Go ahead and scatter them. Make them like Gentiles who are looking for me. Make them indistinguishable. But their lies, their lying lips, their evil words they speak. The reason I've argued that David wrote this the night he wrote it, before you see it, because he's sitting there, to know lying lips, you have to be able to hear the person who's saying it. He's probably here and he can hear it. When he says they go out in the evening and they come back, and who hears? Anyone who listened to my lying lips? Believe me? And go against David? David knows these guys are not honorable men. As he points out, they're bloodthirsty men. They just want me dead. Well, so did all the Sanhedrin want some Messiah dead. Bloodthirsty men. Josh, did you have your hand up a minute? Yes. No. Yes, that's absolutely true. Instead of the Israelite people is a more accurate term. I apologize for misstating that. It's actually the Israelite people that were scattered, not necessarily all it's Judah. Because Judah's been scattered in chunks, but for the most part they're still around. At least a small portion is still around, meaning we can identify them. Everybody else has been intermixed and is impossible to identify between a Gentile and, let's say, somebody from Naphtali. Good luck. Hold on a minute. You go ahead, Richard.
The Jews were not the ones to be hidden. They're scattered like the rest, but they had to identify.
That's true. The Jews were not to be hidden in that manner of speaking. Note,
the remnant's
always around. Scattering is the nature of that. You don't actually wipe everybody out by scattering. You still have a few hanging around. And note, David, of course, was from the tribe of Judah. Was he talking about his own tribe? Yeah, some could argue. At his moment in time. I got two other questions, and I'm out of time. So, Ellie, we'll go for you real quick, if you don't mind. Generation. Yes, Solomon does it. Yeah, the division happens in Solomon's time. You're absolutely right. It is two generations from now. I'll call 1.5. Yes, you, Bill?
Moses.
Right. They're absolutely right. Moses did intercede. He did not want the children or people wiped out. And Moses was, by definition, a messianic figure. It's practically named after it. It was not the object of the messianic figure to wipe out the people he's supposed to go save. So Moses would not want to be wiped out. He may want them reprimanded, corrected, but not wiped out. David does not want the people wiped out. Wants them reprimanded, corrected, but not wiped out. Messiah doesn't want to be wiped out. Wants them reprimanded, corrected, but not wiped out. A consistent pattern. Are there any questions or comments? I apologize for taking you way over time, but, you know, what else is new? Go. Now, unless there's a second Bethlehem. Yeah, unless there's a second one, the one which all my maps have at Bethlehem is about 10 miles. 10 miles north. Interesting. I'll look at that. Because the Bethlehem from David is supposed to be... Oh, that's right. There are two Bethlehems. You're absolutely right. I forgot about that. It says Bethlehem of Ephraim and Bethlehem of Judah. I'll have to double check that. Figure out which one he's... He may not necessarily be the one from in the territory of Judah. I'll look at that. You could be right. I may have incorrect on my map. I'll have to double check that. So I apologize for all those who may be looking at our map and it might be the incorrect Bethlehem that David's from. Sorry about that. Thank you very much. You've stoned me. You've stoned me. Thanks. String him up. Any other comments or questions? Have a wonderful rest of Shabbat.